Hello and welcome. We are in episode 52 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, one that I have chosen to call the Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast meets the Abbott and Costello Show. I'm Jerry Shario, and I would like to introduce to you a man who needs no introduction.
Hi, everyone.
I immediately recognized that lack of introduction, and I get it.
We have far too much fake laughter on this show. We really do.
It's become abundant. But I wanted to say that the interesting thing about this episode, and I don't know if you put this together, but I did, and so did another one of our listeners, that each season of the Abbott and Costello television show had 26 episodes. 26 plus 26 is what?
Carry the three. That's 52.
Correctly. And what is the episode number?
Hold on. It's minus the 52.
Oh my! If this were an Abbott and Costello movie, it would be hold that math expert. I'm surprised you don't have an abacus with you. Abacus and Costello.
There you go.
Boy, we're just rolling on, aren't we? Jerry, first of all, let's get preliminaries out of the way. How you doing?
Yes, sir. I am doing very well, sir. Officially in retirement.
Boy, congratulations.
Yes, pulling Social Security and whatever else I can add on top of it. And yeah. Thus far it's been pulling Social Security, but we'll see what else can get added on top of it.
I like retirement. I mean, I was forced into it, because I had to be a caregiver to my mom.
Yeah.
But I love retirement. I love waking up and thinking, I don't have to be at this place doing something I don't like. So that's a good thing.
Well, for me, retirement is waking up and thinking, what the heck day is it?
Oh, please. I did a Tuesday that I thought was a Monday, and I'm talking all day long. it's crazy. And younger listeners, get ready. Mm-hmm. You're going to be confused. I don't care how cognizant you are. Anyway, let's talk about this.
Yes.
I've been avoiding this for quite a while because I feel like I'm going to get a lot of people angry on this episode because I don't think of their television show, their Abbott and Costello show, the filmed one. I don't find it, how can I put this, as great as most people do. I mm-hmm. prefer the Colgate Comedy Hour. I prefer watching them work in front of a live audience. I prefer them being away from an obnoxious soundtrack. And I don't believe a word of that legend that they ran them in a theater and recorded the laughter. Because I was watching a scene from from season two last night, and a guy picked up a box and put it down. There was hysterical laughter. I'm sorry, but I don't buy it. It doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
And if you have any proof, bring it out and I'll believe it. But nobody seems to have proof. So, yeah, that was an interesting thing. Experiment last night. But I want to read from the definitive book about Abbott and Costello, the annotated Abbott and Costello by Matthew Conium and a guy named Nick Savimanima, and forward by John Landis, the great comedy Ooh. Director. Matthew wrote this, and he speaks for both of us when he writes this. And now this is a little long, so everybody settle in, put on your slippers, have some hot chocolate, and drink it out of your slippers if you want to. I think that's interesting. We're jumping around now. We're not doing, the movies sequentially. Now we're jumping around to different subjects. And I wanted to place perspective where Abbott and Costello were at this point as they were about to film their filmed television show. Okay, this is from the book. Here we go. And thanks in advance to Matthew. 1951 was a vastly more productive year for the team than may first appear. They didn't only make two movies, they also invaded America's homes, making their first four appearances on the Colgate Comedy Hour, to which they would add a further 16 before the end of 1955. and shooting all 26 episodes of the first season of their filmed series, The Abbott and Costello Show. It's worth keeping this in mind, since it reminds us that while their filmography may give the impression that they were slowing down, they were in fact busier than ever. What had shifted, however, was their primary focus. They had always been creatures of the stage, feeding on the rapport with their audiences. For over a decade, they had only been able to satisfy this need to connect with fans in sporadic live appearance tours in between pictures. The Colgate shows brought them back to the format they most loved and best understood. So if they seem a shade lethargic in Abbott and Costello Go to Mars or Lost in Alaska, that's not because they've lost their mojo. It's because they've left it back at NBC. In fact, the sheer logistics of what Bud and Lou were able to do in these years is truly daunting, and it paints a picture of the team's energy and popularity that is strikingly at odds with the death knell sounded by writers who considered only their cinema output when assessing their careers. Though 15 years had passed since they first teamed in Burlesque, the Colgate programs are bursting with energy, ad-libs, unapologetic flubs, and sheer joyousness. And they're revealing, as well, we get a far more spontaneous look at how they interrelate as performers than in the carefully controlled environment of the movie studio. How each responds to the audience and to the unexpected. How they help each other get back on track if the other loses their way. And yes, there are occasional fascinating flashes of temperament to be spotted too. Critics carped, as ever, that they relied on their old tried and true routines. If they had both eyes open, they would have realized just what a priceless resource that made these shows. Here are sketches we are all familiar with from the films, taking on an often strikingly organic and independent existence as they are shaped and molded on the spot to the vagaries of audience response. We watch some elements shrink, while others are enlarged. We get a truer sense of just how complete their gifts are, as stand-ups, as sketch actors, as physical clowns. The hammock scene in the Navy is funny, for sure, but when you watch Lou on TV falling out of that damn thing repeatedly, and for real, no cuts, no stand-ins, no breaks to get a second wind, slick avenues of glistening sweat running from his face, you understand just how first-rate a clown he truly was. Bud, too. That way of confiding with an audience while talking to Lou that we only get to see occasionally before is given free rein. It works a charm. Sure, most of our material is from Burlesque, Bud told Erskine Johnson in response to these critical gripes. But what comedy today isn't from Burlesque? Nobody can write anything new. If Lionel Barrymore had done our material, the critics would have said it was artistic. In a 1953 interview with Bob Thomas, the boys explained what a new lease of life TV had given them. 10 or 12 years ago, we'd get mobbed wherever we went because of our movies, Lou remarked. After a few years, that sort of thing died down. But we're getting it all over again. I just took a trip east. When I stopped over in Chicago, I had to make my way through the kids. When I walked through the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria in New York, it was a mob scene. The same thing happened here in town. I used to take my kid to the amusement park with no trouble at all. Now I can't go there unless I want to sit down and write autographs for an hour. Both comics agreed that they both work hard for the new revival of their careers. The show looks like a breezy, easy hour, but Lou said, I'd rather make a feature picture than do one live show on TV. TV is actually harder work than pictures. Before starting to prepare for a show, I go in training just like a prize fighter. I'm constantly working on new ideas for the show. The boys are keeping up their strenuous schedule. Don't they ever run out of material? That doesn't worry us, answered Bud. Why, when we were in Burlesque, we played the same theater for 5 years, changing the show every week. We've got enough material to last us as long as we live. Most of the big comedy stars, that is the ones who still had some juice left in them, were relocating to television at this point. The striking thing about Bud and Lou is not that they were doing likewise, but that they were able to maintain a full-on film career too, notching up a further 10 big screen titles between 1951 and 1956. Only Bob Hope managed to equal this productivity at the movies while simultaneously wooing the home audience, and he didn't have a film TV series of his own. That series, The Abbott and Costello Show, is very much a game of two halves. While the second season is a legitimate sitcom, the first season, which they completed with such extraordinary dispatch in 1951, is a cheerful, unpretentious hodgepodge of routines linked by the slenderest of threads and a lot of goodwill. Scenarios are cobbled together solely as means to provide segues into classic sketches, almost all of which get a victory lap in the 26 shows. The episodes often establish nominal plot lines that they make no effort whatever to resolve, and frequently abandon entirely. What continuity they do possess is mainly due to the rep company casting, with notable regular appearances from Hilary Brooke, who had appeared in Africa Screams and would soon reappear in Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd, as their neighbor, she always refers to Lou as Lewis, and Joe Besser, gloriously, awesomely bizarre as Stinky, the obnoxious and distinctly mature neighborhood kid. I'll harm you! The shows get by and have remained enduringly popular, partly because the material, for the most part, just can't fail, and also because they are the Bud and Lou equivalent of fast food. Quick hits of comedic salt and sugar, without any of the distractions of a Hollywood production. What the shows are, therefore, is roundups, and as such, of no small value. They are not filmed before an audience, however, so it is to the Colgate shows that you should hurry for a real taste of what the boys were doing and could do at this point in their careers. Quite simply, if you haven't seen the Colgate shows, you don't really know Abbott and Costello in the 50s at all. So it tells us that the Colgate shows are the organic, real Abbott and Costello doing what they did best in front of a live audience. The film show, the Abbott and Costello Show, the first season really is a delight. It's crazy. It's hodgepodge. It's thrown together. But it is a lot of fun, and it's very funny. The second season, however, you could almost hear the crash as it falls. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like right away, we can talk to it. We'll talk about it when we get to that season. But right now, I'm going to explain what we did for this episode. I left it to Jerry, because of his infinite, wonderful taste, to pick six episodes, since we can't do all 52, six episodes of the TV show, three from column A, and no, wait, that's Chinese food, three from the first season and three from the second season. And we will be discussing all of those. And we're going to start incredibly with the first season. And before I forget, I would like to thank listener Peter Freeman. As Jerry and I were listening to the Marx Brother Council podcast, Peter Freeman actually gave a shout out to us and our podcast, and we want to thank him for that. And we want to thank Bob Bissell, their producer, for following it up with a nice plug. We appreciate it. Thank you. And we just returned the plug just now. So anyway, let's discuss these first season of the Abbott and Costello Show. Now, the differences here are the first show has a look. It has a concept, it seems. The two of them come out in front of a curtain like they would in a live show. Mm-hmm. And usually do a little bit of a bit to get things started. And we're looking at an episode called Vacation. And I have to say that of all six, this is my favorite. it's no coincidence that it's the earliest one of the bunch. I noticed a few things about this. First of all, they had music. Raoul Kraschauer was their music director. And there was music in the background during scenes. There's that wonderful theme song, which also happens to be our theme song. And it's just fantastic. And you hear it all the way through. Unfortunately, in the second season, they had to make budget cuts. And again, we'll get to that when we get to it. So one thing I wanted to mention about this show is that Lou owned the show. It was his show. He hired Bud as an actor, and I was perfectly okay with Bud. who was about to produce his own film for the first time, Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd, and he learned just how tough a job it is. So anyway, Lou owned the show, and immediately, and this is, I have to give him credit, he hired their very first producer from their earliest films. The first eight films, I believe, was Alex Gottlieb, who was also recently did Jack and the Beanstalk. He produced Jack and the Beanstalk and was about to produce Captain Kidd. But Lou asked him to produce the show, but only the first couple of episodes, just to get them started. And Alex was actually happy to do so. Unfortunately, our big businessman, Lou Costello, he could have really made out on this. I mean, and he did. I'll tell you the truth. This show saved him after the IRS took most of what he had. Mm. The show supported him and his family for the final years of his life. So anyway, what's the point I'm making? I wish I knew. No. when it came time to sell the show, NBC was like champing at the bit. They wanted the show. NBC. Now, this would have been a network show. It would have been on at a set time around the country. Everyone would have said, oh boy, 8:30, Abbott and Costello on Monday. Uh-uh. Lou held out. He kept holding out for a better deal. Mm. And you know what? Sometimes that bites you in the butt. And that's exactly what happened to Lou. It got down to the fact that he had to accept a syndication deal. Now, syndication means that you sell it market to market. And the show is on at different times in different parts of the country, different episodes. They're not done sequentially. So it's confusing and it's not as profitable. So Lou kind of blew it there. In New York, the show ran at 10:30 at night on the CBS affiliate. And it wasn't the CBS network. It was after local programming resumed at 10:30. So Abbott and Costello show was considered local programming rather than a regular network show. The second season was on an NBC affiliate. But anyway, that was a bad thing. The second season also suffered because they had to let go of some of their cast members. Matthew mentioned the repertory company, the great, great character actors that, you know, were sprinkled in the show. But they got rid of Joe Kirk as Mr. Bacigalup, Hillary, gone, and worst of all, Joe Besser as Stinky, gone.
Yes.
Goodbye. Oh. Who makes you laugh more than Stinky, you know? Yeah, but thank God we still had Mike the Cop. We still had mm-hmm. Mr. Fields, you know. So there were still a couple of people from the first season, but still not good. Okay, so the first season was shot at Hal Roach Studios. How about that? Mm. The second season, they had to cut down budget, and they went to the Motion Picture Center Studios. But that was also quite a good studio. Their movie Meet Captain Kidd was shot there later on, and it soon became Desilu Studio. Mm. Lucy shot there, Jack Benny, Danny Thomas, and Abbott and Costello. So anyway, that's the kind of like the background of the show itself. So let's get to the first episode in the first season. Like I said, we hear our wonderful theme song, and the boys come out in front of a curtain, and they do U-Drive, the U-Drive routine. I love the U-Drive routine.
Yes.
If his head hurts, let him take an aspirin. Their head writer from their radio show wrote these first few episodes. Eddie Foreman was his name. And it's one of the reasons the first season is so fresh. You know, they didn't go back to Clyde Bruckman, let's say, who was pretty much just recycling material that he already recycled. So here's my big discovery. After watching this TV show my entire life, seriously, starting from like the age of five, I just noticed this for the first time. As they are standing in front of the curtain doing their crosstalk routine about U-Drive, each of them are reading cue cards.
Yes!
I never noticed it before. They're looking.
Yeah! Past,
and Lou especially is kind of, he stops to like squint. How did I not notice it? Did you notice it, Jerry?
This time, yes. But as with you, never before. But yeah, I remember it just jumped out at me as I'm watching this.
Yeah, but now it seems to make sense because they have their normal stance. You know, they do, you know, Bud is more turned towards Lou. Lou is more turned towards us. And that's their stance. But that's where they set the cue cards. Makes perfect sense. So anyway, another reason why I like the Colgate show better. Okay. I didn't see any cue cards in it. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, they did. They did have some gags. Lou used to talk to the cue card. Quite a bit, actually.
Yes.
Which was kind of funny. All right. So they're going on vacation and they're going to Phoenix. No. They're going to the Biltmore Hotel near Phoenix.
Yes.
I used to love this one when I was a kid. Now, another thing I wanted to bring up, and this is something, again, Matthew mentioned in our book, Lou's costume. Lou, all of a sudden, when he started on television, he developed this costume, this checkered coat, you know, with kind of baggy pants, two-tone shoes, black and white shoes, and this derby, a long tie that he puts in his mouth more often than not, and this adorable derby on the top of his head. Matthew doesn't like it. He thinks it's too, you know, it's just too, how can I put it? It's like, I'm the funny guy. I'm going to dress funny, right?
Almost like a children's entertainer.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it. And I think I agree with him. I would have preferred him with the turned up fedora and, you know, a sloppy suit, maybe the jacket a little too tight. But anyway, he's got his costume now and he uses it for the rest of the show. Although he changes his jacket in the second season, he wears the jacket he wore in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Okay, so here's another interesting thing. Did you see the guy he does the first routine with where he's going into Mr. Fields' boarding house and he's stopped by that really big guy?
Yes.
That's Glenn Strange. They must have really liked working together. They did Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. They did Coming Round the Mountain. What else did they do together? They did Abbott and Costello Meet the Creature on the Colgate show. Mm-hmm. So they worked with Glenn. And I love that because he was, to us monster kids, he was special.
Yeah.
And I looked at, as they were doing the routine, I looked past them. And there's a sign in front of the boarding house saying that rooms were $7 a week.
Yes.
So $28 a month to live with Mr. Fields' boarding house. I love it. That's something I noticed. I really enjoyed. Did you like the bit he did with Glenn Strange?
Yes. Yes. With the photographs. Yeah.
Great punch.
It was one that... You could see it coming, and yet when it came, I laughed.
It's still funny. It's such a clever joke. So anyway, what we're getting at is that, you know, Glenn is accusing Lou of diddling with his girlfriend, and he has pictures, and he keeps showing them to Lou. And finally, when he says, so, what are you going to do about it? And Lou just says,
I'll take 2 days, 3 days, this week and have lunch.
Very funny stuff. Very funny stuff. So they're going on vacation, but they need supplies because, let's face it, everyone knows that Abbott and Costello would be horseback riding, fishing, hunting. You know, they need guns. They need baseballs. They need, you know, it's like, what?
And then the other thing is, they're a month behind in their rent to Mr. Fields, but they're going to buy all of this equipment to take a vacation at the Biltmore Hotel.
But they're buying it from a relative of Mr. Fields, their landlord.
Yes.
His name is Sporty Fields. Because he sells sporting goods. Now, this sequence is just wonderful. It's just wonderful. First of all, he mentions Mr. Bronson when they walk in. Oh, I'll take care of Mr. Bronson. Milt Bronson, their good buddy, the guy who actually saved Lou's life by treating him after, you know, when he first got rheumatic fever. So Bronson was a lifetime employee for the boys. And his wife shows up in a bunch of these, Lillian Bronson. Oh. So they were good friends, and they were all in burlesque together, of course. I love the lady roller skater. The guy is putting roller skates on this lady, and when she goes skating out, Lou accidentally removes her skirt, and on her panties, it's just elbows McGillicuddy. She's what is it called?
The roller derby. Yeah.
Roller derby. Thank you. So that was very funny. I love the joke about his brother-in-law and the alligator. So funny. You see this belt? What is that? Pure alligator? No, pure brother-in-law. So I'm just going to say, if you don't know these jokes, go back to your shows and look up Vacation. I love Lou in the boat. And he pulls the motor and the boat starts going in the store and then into a tent where it's revealed that Bobby Barber is there. It's like he lives in the tent. And then, of course, Bud, in order to justify his paycheck, because he's been sound asleep through this whole thing, he finally gets into it and he does the old boat jokes with Lou.
What do you know about boats?
I know plenty about boats, big boy. Don't think I don't know anything about boats.
You know
big
everything,
boy.
Where's the bow of the boat?
What's the matter? You think you got me stuck or something?
Where's the bow of the boat?
Where's the bow of the boat?
Yeah, where is it?
Everybody knows where the bow of the boat. Where is the bow of the boat? That's in the front.
Where's the stern?
That's in the back.
Where's the port?
It's in the icebox.
But anyway, so they go through that and they end up buying their stuff at Sporty Fields' place. And I like the bit with Mike the Cop and the long rubber band. It's hard to explain. So if you want to go look at Vacation, first season, it's a funny bit with poor Mike. If there's something heavy that has to hit somebody on the head, that's Mike's job.
Yep.
Gordon Jones, the great Gordon Jones. Okay. I really enjoyed the scene where Mr. Fields comes into their apartment and inadvertently turns Lou into a lamp. Lou is standing there as Mr. Fields is taking the lamp and he puts the bulb in his mouth and it goes on. He puts the lampshade on his head and the whole time he's standing there, Lou, and they think he's a lamp. I'm not doing it justice, but please, again, another great sequence. And this leads to one of my favorite sequences, and not only in the movies, but in this show, Pack and Unpack.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Come on. And it's a great version of it. Bud is just, this is Bud. This is Bud's scene. Lou is very funny packing and unpacking, of course. But Bud and his line of spiel that I know he's making up as he goes along is very funny. I mean, that's Emmy material.
You talk about Bud, you know, earning his paycheck for the episode. I think this one scene alone earned him like three paychecks right there.
He gets it. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that's where we go. You know, this is one of the things our podcast has taught me in doing this is that Bud was the greatest straight man of all time, but mostly during routines. That's where Bud was valuable. That's where no one did it better, you know?
Yep.
Away from the routines, no, I think other people could have played his role. I'm sorry, but it's true. Mm-hmm. But nobody could do those routines like Bud. Nobody. Okay, so here's another thing I remember from childhood so vividly. When Lou is packed up, he's got the snowshoes, he's got golf clubs, he's got skis, he's got, you know, I'm surprised he didn't have like a horse saddle with him. He's trying to leave so he can pack up the car. He's trying to leave the apartment and Hillary keeps stopping him. So he has to put down all the stuff, go to Hillary, and Hillary usually says something very inconsequential. He has to go back, pick up everything, and then Hillary calls him back. Anyway, the punchline is kind of lame. He's like, you know, Hillary, I could fall for you. And of course, you know, when he steps outside, you're going to hear him fall. But the weird part is, and this is the part I remember from childhood, because even then I thought it was bizarre. They cut to a close-up of Hillary. After Lou falls, she just looks at us and says, you know, I think he did fall for her. You know what I mean? But it wasn't funny. it wasn't necessary, and it was bizarre.
Yes.
It was really bizarre. Bud has a few of those in the series, too, where they just cut to a close-up of him saying something so innocuous and so stupid. You know, you just wonder, did they have extra film in the camera?
Well, you know, they did have to pad those episodes out to whatever, what, 25, 24 minutes, you know, so.
Yeah, right? That wasn't enough, but they did popcorn commercials and all that other stuff. I love their popcorn commercials. Go on YouTube, you'll find them there. Okay, so then Mr. Fields does a version of the same joke that Hillary just did. As Lou is downstairs, he puts down all the stuff. Mr. Fields is up at the top of the stairs, and he's calling Lou. Lou? And Lou is like, you're not going to say goodbye, are you? And he's like, no. And he puts all the stuff down. He walks up the stairway, and he says, well, what do you want to say? And Mr. Fields says, have a good time. And I have to say, even though it's kind of the same joke we just experienced with Hillary, it's still funny. I don't think Sid Fields could not be funny. You know what I mean? He's one of those guys that just delivers on every channel. He's just wonderful. So then they go into a gag from The Noose Hangs High, and that's the car. The trunk opening, you close the trunk, the hood opens, back and forth, back and forth. What I love is how much they put in the car. Like I said, the vacation, you can only imagine that they don't sleep on this vacation. They are so, let's go horseback riding, let's go mountain climbing, let's do all these things you would never imagine these two men doing in their lifetime. So they are going to the Biltmore Hotel near Phoenix, and they put a inflated life raft into the car. So they can't see anyway. And they get started, and they drive, literally, they drive for about 3 seconds before Lou stops the car in front of the Biltmore Hotel, which is just three buildings down from where they live. Bud says, no, we're talking about the Biltmore Hotel near Phoenix. And Lou points to the restaurant next door, which is the Phoenix restaurant. And Bud, of course, slaps him. And Lou tells him that that's the last time he goes on a long vacation with him. This is the best of the six picked. This is the best. This is the funniest.
Oh, yeah.
Got the best routines in it. They're still very lively, you know. Just great stuff in this one. Good choice, Mr. Jerry. And I like the Grand Canyon joke at the end. And he warns Bud about falling 15,000 feet into the canyon. And he tells him, as you're falling, look to the left, because you will never see a sight like that again. Really good stuff. Okay, so we had Alex Gottlieb producing. We had Eddie Foreman writing. And we had, what's his name, Gene Yarborough directing. Mm-hmm. And he directed every episode, all 52 episodes. And this came about because they were already working with him on the current movies they were doing. It was a very comfortable fit. Gene Yarborough was a very easygoing director and let them pretty much do what they wanted to do. And that's how you direct Abbott and Costello. Okay, so that was the first episode. Any blanket statement you'd like to make that will cover it? Get it? Blanket statement, cover it?
Got it, yeah. I got it. In spite of that comment, yes. You've pretty much covered all the points that attracted me to this particular episode. One of the things I loved about it was that it was so prop heavy. Lou was just going to town on anything and everything that seemed to be available. You know, everything from a baseball up to the car that could never make up its mind what to close and what to open. And he did such a great job. He always does such a great job with that kind of stuff. And to me, those are the moments where I'm never 100% sure if it's in the script or if he just came up with it at the moment, because it flows so nicely. And
yeah.
I love
there
the
were a
episode.
Couple moments I noticed exactly what you just described. I noticed Lou going off, you know what I mean? Just finding something, a hook, and attempting a routine to create one on the spot, like they did in Whodunit with the Watts Volts That was all spontaneous. All right. So the next one, interesting choice, because this is vacuum cleaner salesman, vacuum cleaner. Things changed by this point. The executive producer is now Pat Costello, Lou's brother. Apparently, he didn't do much, but I'm sure he was well taken care of. And Gene Yarbrough now became the producer slash director. And that's for all the rest of the shows. Eddie Foreman is still the writer here. And interestingly, Bud has his mustache at this point. This is the mustache he grew for originally for Jack and the Beanstalk. And I have to say, it makes him look older. I liked him without the mustache better.
I agree. Yeah.
It ages him like 10 years, it seems. I notice as the show is going on, Bud becomes less sharp. His delivery is a little less sharp. His timing is a little less on. I just think he was tired, to be honest. I just think he was tired. They were, like Matthew described in our book, they were working on all cylinders, and he was not a young man.
I didn't go and look, but I know there is an episode, probably just one or two before this one, where as the episode starts, you know, they're in front of the curtain, the usual opening, he has no mustache. And in the middle of the episode, they're like on the run from Mike the cop, and they're in the doorway of a shop, and Bud turns around and says, well, maybe this mustache will help me to hide from Mike. And then they go on. It's like, well, we filmed all this stuff, and now we've got to come back and finish the episode, and now Bud's got a mustache. What do we do? Well, just make up a line, and then we'll go on and ignore it.
And that's exactly – okay. What you just described perfectly describes the first season. It perfectly describes it. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered. It was surreal. It's why the show is so popular with people. And I'm just going to throw this in very quickly. Entertainment Weekly and Time Magazine both called it one of the 100 top influential shows of all time. Can you imagine? I mean, it's why Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David went to it. They just loved the surreal quality and the fact that there were no lessons learned. You know, there was no moral at the end. It just ended. Things would just end. So I don't know. That's, you just described what the show is all about. Bud doesn't have a mustache. All of a sudden he has a mustache. It makes no sense. So anyway, vacuum cleaner. Of course, as Bud will tell you, you need a job. I've got to find you a job. But the whole opening scene, they do a very short opening in front of the curtain. No routine. But when the show opens up, Lou does a pantomime scene with a young lady, and I was transfixed. See, this to me is great stuff. You get to see Lou do stuff that you normally don't see him do. So here he is flirting with this young lady. He even takes out this little monkey puppet. I wish I had that puppet. you know? And I have to say, as I'm looking at my notes here, it's great pantomime. He's his face alone is worth the price of admission. So I just want to tell you, if you're watching this episode, the vacuum cleaner salesman, watch this opening scene. You're going to see Lou like you've never seen him before. And of course, whatchamacallit, Mike, the cop. what happens to him in this? Does he get hit with a hammer or something in the face? I forget. Instead of grabbing Lou, he grabs Barbie Barber.
What do you mean by obstructing justice?
I'm justice.
Justice what?
Just as good as you are.
So anyway, we cut to the boys, and they do another one of their classic routines. But true to form, since the show is so low budget, it's instead of loan me $50, it's loan me 50 cents. That's how poor they are. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, Lou can't loan him that. He's only got 40 cents. Well, give me the 40 and you'll owe me 10. And they do the whole routine that they did in Buck Privates 10 years before. And it's great and it works. But I also like they added at the end the IOU joke.
Yes.
They bring back in Keystone Cops. So Bud wants to do everything officially. So he makes out the IOU, $0.50 cents, blah, blah, blah. And he makes Lou sign it. So now it's official. While this is going on, our friend Stinky. Now, Stinky, as you guys know, is played by Joe Besser, a somewhat corpulent, bald, middle-aged man dressed as Little Lord Fauntleroy, pretending he's a child. Now, this may be my favorite aspect of this television show, is the fact that there is someone like Stinky running around the neighborhood. You talk about living in a stinky neighborhood. I just got to tell you, it's hilarious. And of course, Lou and Stinky bond because they're like the same age. You know, they're both kids. But in this one, this is the classic scene that they did in Africa Screams with Joe Besser, where he keeps running in, interrupting them. I need a glass of water. And he runs off again. He comes back. I need more water. And he does this like four times, running back and forth. And finally, Lou stops him and says, why do you need all this water? My apartment's on fire. And fire is two syllables. Fire. It's like in the very first episode when he wants castor oil. Oil is two syllable. Oil. So anyway, that's the big stinky scene right there. But anyway, Lou needs a job. Bud really feels that Lou needs a job so he can support Bud. So they decide to go to one of Mr. Fields' relatives at the Fields Employment Agency, where there is a toupee'd Mr. Fields. I think he has a mustache in this too. And he runs this cockamamie employment agency. And they go through a whole bunch of employment gags and, you know, what have you. We also see the great Dorothy Ford for just a moment. Dorothy Ford was the Amazon, one of the Amazons, basketball players in mm-hmm. Here Come the Co-eds. She also is the Giants housekeeper in Jack and the Beanstalk. And she shows up in a couple of Abbott and Costello shows as well. So I love the fact that a lot of the people they worked with recently and who they formed a bond with were invited to be on the show, which is always good. Not only is it good, you know, for a paycheck and all that, the way the Screen Actors Guild is set up, they get health insurance as well. So that was always a very kind thing for people to do, is hire their friends. Okay, so Mr. Fields, I love when Lou is filling out the form and he can't get the ink to come out. So he shakes the pen and the ink shows up on Mr. Fields' forehead down the bridge of his nose. And he doesn't know it's there through the entire scene. Made yep. me laugh every time I looked at it. This is the simplicity of this show. They decide that Lou is going to be a vacuum cleaner salesman. And of course, Mr. Fields has the vacuum right behind the counter with all of the attachments and everything else. And Bud and Mr. Fields do a demonstration of how Lou should sell the vacuum cleaner. And of course, it's made to be too good to be true. And Lou thinks, boy, this is easy. This is going to be good. So cut to Little Giant without any of the plot points, without any of the pathos. Mm-hmm. It's just the vacuum cleaner gags. And that's, you know, the old stuff of putting your foot in the door, which has a nice punchline. I like when the shoe hits him in the head at the end. And then, of course, why is Mike the cop living with a wife in a house in a small neighborhood when we know he's Mike the cop and he lives at the boarding house with the boys?
I wondered that myself because it's never, he appears and say, you know, accusing Lou of trying to do hanky-panky with his wife. And Lou never acknowledges that it's Mike. But yeah, it's Gordon Jones. Come on.
It's Gordon Jones. It's the show. It is the Abbott and Costello show. And it is completely surreal. And it's why I like it. It's why I like the first season. Bud has another line that I just love. And you have to really listen. He makes Lou pick up everything. The vacuum cleaner, the attachments, the big suitcase. And he says, as Lou is trying to pick up everything.
Come on, pick it up. Want me to do it?
He's so funny. Anyway, so we finish up at the farmhouse interesting setup. There's a medium shot of the two of them talking with the farmhouse in the background, and it's obviously a rear projection photograph of the farmhouse. And then when they show them walking towards the farmhouse, it's two really bad doubles doing the location work. They go into the place, and Lou does a trick with his hat. He like does its little flip with his hat. And these are the things I loved most. I used to do it. I still can do it. I did it all through my Biffle and Schuster movies. I did it with my hat. So thank you, Lou. But this used to bother me when I was a kid, this episode, when he put all the garbage on the floor and then to find out that they have no electricity. And he makes the stupid remark earlier, if I don't pick this up, I'll eat it. And the scene ends with him just about to put this mouthful of disgusting dirt into his mouth. And they luckily faded out before he was able to do that.
But yes.
I remember being so bothered by that when I was a kid. You know, that was a little too cruel for me. Eating dirt off the floor. But anyway, and then I have written down here, fire. Why was that? Oh, he sets the place on fire. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. It's disastrous. So anyway, that's the vacuum cleaner episode. And again, a good choice. Not one of my favorites. So Jerry, your assessment of this classic episode of this classic series.
Well, I think the biggest mistake they ever made was getting rid of Joe Besser, first and foremost. I mean, I know the routine. As the two of them and Mr. Fields are standing in the hallway and Stinky comes running through, get out of my way! I know it's coming. I know it's coming. And yet, when he delivered the punchline, I literally laughed out loud. I could not contain it.
And that is a classic bit. It really is a classic bit. Fire! Oh, boy. Oh, wait. I have a quick clip from Kevin Brownlow here that Peter Friedman requested because he knew it was available. Hold on. I just want to play it very quickly. It's from the Bud Abbott Variety Show, and it's a guest that, you know, most people didn't expect, that's for sure. Let's listen to that, if you don't mind, just very quickly. It's short. It's very short.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Bud Abbott Variety Show. I'm Bud Variety. I mean Abbott. I'm Bud Abbott. That's me. Bud Abbott. Oh, talk sense, Abbott. I'd like to introduce my first guest. Here he is. He's the poet laureate of the United States. Please welcome Mr. Ogden Nash.
Yay!
Hello, Mr. Abbott. I just want to say hello, Mr. Abbott. I won't make it a habit because if you... Quiet! What is this with the cheap rhymes? What do you work for, Burma Shave? Get out of here! Who is Ogden Nash? He gives me a rash. Now get out of here in a flash. See how easy it is? I could be Ogden.
And that's all we have. but I wanted Peter to hear that because he is the one who made me aware. Okay. So let's get back to the subject at hand.
Please, please. Sorry. Yes. Please do.
Okay. Boy, that was exciting. And entirely ad-libbed. I did not think about that beforehand. Okay, so I want to know your assessment of repeating the gags from Little Giant. I mean, you know, unabashedly dredging them up and not changing them at all, really.
Well, you have to consider the fact that when they made these movies, they would play in the theater for, what, a couple of weeks, maybe? Mm-hmm. And then they'd go back in a vault.
Right.
They might get a re-release 5 years down the road, but would play for probably even less time, and then they disappear again.
Right.
And like now, you and I, along with many others, could just sit and watch every single Abbott and Costello movie, one right after the other, and have a jolly good time. And because of that, we remember that this was from that movie and that was from this movie. I think they were banking on the fact that people maybe had seen Little Giant, but that would have been, when was that?
Like 5 or 6 years earlier.
At least, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so why not? Why not do it again? You know, it got a laugh, so let's do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Good point. That's true. And the material was all there, you know, it was easy. And from what Matthew wrote and what I read earlier, the first season was done very quickly, extremely fast. So, boy, and it sure looks it. In a good way. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So the next episode we have, and this is the last from the first season, it's called Peace and Quiet. And I have to just comment right away because, first of all, the cast is maybe the best of the entire series. It's, get ready, Marjorie Reynolds from The Time of Their Lives.
Mm-hmm.
Melody. Joe Besser as Stinky. Vita Ann Borg, who is one of the queens of B-movies. And if you're a B-movie fan or even a movie fan, you know Vita Ann Borg. Then Lillian Bronson, Milt Bronson's wife, and the great, great Murray Leonard.
Yep.
Pocomoco. playing, what you call it, Murray Leonard. He plays the doctor in this, doesn't he? At the Institute. Okay. The opening scene I found very interesting because there was no routine and it actually set up the plot for the show. Go figure. Lou is tired. He's tired. And from what Bud said, he sleeps all day and he can't understand why he can't sleep at night. again, it's surreal. But the most surreal thing about this scene, the opening scene in front of the curtain, and I don't know if you acknowledge this or not, Jerry, but Bud actually says, I have a good friend who's a psychiatrist. Bud has a good friend who's a psychiatrist? And I'm not talking about the real Bud Abbott. I'm talking about this ne'er-do-well who lives in Mr. Fields' boarding house because they don't have jobs. So,
yeah.
The friend who's a psychiatrist. Okay. I just found that very amusing. Okay. So they go to the psychiatrist's office and they're sitting in the waiting room. And of course, when you're sitting in the waiting room of a psychiatrist, you're going to meet a guy in a propeller hat who thinks he's an airplane. And you're going to meet a little guy who plays a piano that isn't there. So it's this sensitivity towards, you know, mental health that I find so enduring. but it's very funny. It's very funny. The guy in the propeller hat, he has to take off at 4 o'clock, you know, in order to get to where he's going on time. And Bobby Barber does this whole solo on the no piano, you know, totally flummoxing Lou. But then they go in and they see Dr. Mildew. Now, I'm wondering why this wasn't another, it's Mr. Fields. I mean, it's Sid Fields, but why wasn't it, Nutty Fields, you know, Mental Fields, you know, Strawberry Fields, one of them. But I love the whole routine about the salami sandwich. You know,
yes.
Lou totally underplays it, but he kills it. It's just great. So they do this whole routine with Mr. Fields as the psychiatrist. And then Bud gets the idea to buy Dr. Drowsy's record. Now, Dr. Drowsy put together a record of music that will put you to sleep in no time. So that gives them license to do material from Abbott and Costello in Hollywood, including one of my favorites are the earplugs. And you know the earplug routine. You know, one puts the earplugs in, can't hear what the other one is saying, so they switch and it ad nauseum. But what I liked about this version is when they pull out the earplugs, you hear a I can't hear you. Okay. So I really like that. And that routine is just great. Another thing I noticed, why does Lou sleep with his shoes on? He's got his pajamas on, he's in bed, and he's got his shoes on. I don't get it. Now, another thing I want to mention, and this is a classic comedy trope. And if, you know, people listening right now, you'll probably know what I'm talking about. Think back to like Duck Soup, okay? Harpo accidentally thinks the radio is a safe and he turns the knobs and the radio turns on, of course, in top volume when he's supposed to be quiet. But what's playing? Stars and Stripes Forever. That's playing on the radio? Every time a comedian, especially the Stooges, every time they turn on a radio, it's some sort of marching song. Who's a song? In this case, Lou is awakened by a military bugle call. What's it doing on the radio? Here, turn on the radio. That happens in so many old comedies, and I never understood it. But anyway, so Lou can't sleep. He still can't sleep. So he's got to go to a place where he can get peace and quiet. And this is where they do the very best version of Crazy House, one of the classic burlesque routines of all time. This was a routine that they would save for the finale. That's how popular it was. And you could add to it, you could take away from it, you could add extra jokes. You know, comedians would run on and surprise the person on stage with something entirely new. It was literally a crazy house. So they go in, and for some reason, Hillary is a nurse there. I guess we didn't know that about her. Not only annoying people in the apartment, she works as a nurse, and she looks very nice in her nurse outfit. The doctor is Murray Leonard, our friend, mm-hmm. Murray Leonard. And of course, they do the maternity ward scene from Hit the Ice, where they think Lou is a mother, and they hand him a child. Here's your son. Oh, here you go, the baby boy. And of course, they have to take it away after they realize Lou is not the mother. But what we loved when we were kids, in this episode, was Lou, I want my baby. I want my baby. Give me back my baby. Here's my baby. I want my baby. It was very funny. So anyway, yes, I'm saying that this is the best version of Crazy House because they screwed it up twice. First in Ride 'Em Cowboy, they made it a dream sequence and destroyed it. It was the pacing, everything about it. They just took everything away. Then they did it on the Colgate Comedy Hour. And for some reason, they added this musical number in the middle of it where these four singers, they don't even sing. They're mouthing to like Spike Jones, a record. And they're doing this song. And it seems to last forever. And it's not funny. They kind of blew it there, too. And they could have done the best version of it because it was live. But it turns out that this is the very best version of Crazy House. I love Bobby Barber and Milt Bronson coming in. You will. I won't. You will. I won't. You won't. And they keep coming back. Oh, it's so funny. And then Vita Amborg picking apples from the watermelon tree. That's another thing I love. So this goes on and on and on. There's one moment, Jerry, and tell me if you noticed this, when Vita Amborg comes to water the flower bed, and she's actually watering Lou, who is in a nightshirt. Lou stands up to show us how wet he is, and he's wet from top to bottom. And Hillary comes in as the nurse, and they have a moment together where Lou looks entirely embarrassed, and Hillary looks at him like he wet himself. Did you notice this? It's very clear, and I don't know how they got away with it. But she looks at him like, I can't believe you did that.
I think I was too busy noticing that once Lou got doused with all that water, once he stood up, you realize that his nightshirt was rather transparent.
Yes.
Whatever pattern was on his boxer shorts was bright and obvious through the nightshirt. I think that's what got my attention.
Well, I don't want to interfere with your private life. That was definitely a urine joke, I'm telling you. I also like, he's a pump, pump him, he's a pump, pump him. Not that so much as Lou imitating her.
I'm a pump, pump him, he's a pump, pump him.
It's very funny. And then, do you want your palm red? That classic bit.
Mm-hmm.
And when Lou shoots himself with his finger. And it's so clever. The red that's on his hand after he paints his hand red, he puts his hand to his heart and he thinks it's blood. And then the apples, of course. She's picking the apples from the watermelon tree. And you know, of course, Lou has to get up and test it, and all the apples fall on his head. if you remember the Colgate Comedy Hour, he blew it. He blew it. He ruined the timing of it because he ad-libbed an extra joke. So the timing was completely off. The apples fell on nothing and missed him. And he was not happy. But it was his fault. And then I liked, this is one of those scenes, like Hillary looking at the camera and saying, you know, I think he did. When Bud comes in and he wraps up the scene in a very sweet way, he's so concerned about his partner in this episode. Mm-hmm. It's so endearing, and I really like it.
Oh, I'm so happy I brought him here. What a peaceful and restful time he's having. Rest, oh boy, rest.
You know, it was very touching. So that's the end of our look at season one. Do you have anything you want to say about this episode?
No, you pretty much covered it. I mean, I've always enjoyed the Crazy House, even when it's not done well. You know, it has its moments, you know. Yeah. Ride'em Cowboy, as you pointed out, was perhaps the most butchered it got. But just to be able to see it somewhat uncut, somewhat natural, somewhat, you know, this is as close as we're going to get to it, be sitting in a house and having them on stage doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are some things out there, and this is, listen up, everybody. If you go on YouTube and you put This Was Burlesque, you're going to get a series of recent, not recent, but, you know, in the 70s, maybe the early 80s, actual burlesque shows that would tour around the country. In fact, hosted by one of Lou and Ann Costello's best friends, Ann Corio. She wrote a book about it. She wrote This Was Burlesque. I grew up on that book. And she took out the tour every year, and they would do Crazy House, and it was usually the finale, and they did it really well. And there was usually a star comic playing the Lou part. Okay, so that's the end of our look at season one. Let's get to season two. I know we both have a lot to say about season one. First of all, you picked one called Efficiency Experts. Very interesting episode, written by Clyde Bruckman, the notorious Clyde Bruckman. Now, I know we talked about Clyde Bruckman before, but it's worth mentioning now since we're in Clyde Bruckman land. Clyde Bruckman worked with Buster Keaton. He co-directed and co-wrote The General. I mean, The General. Come on. He worked with Harold Lloyd. I mean, he really worked with the best, and he wrote some wonderful material for W.C. Fields as well. But he was one of those guys where the well dried up, and he was drinking and all this stuff. So he started borrowing from himself. The problem was he did not own the material. He was writing for other people. And the only one that took him to task was probably the richest man, one of the richest men in Hollywood, someone who did not need to do this to poor Clyde Bruckman. Clyde Bruckman was a, you know, it was pitiful, really. So what did Harold Lloyd do? He sued Clyde Bruckman and ruined whatever was left of his career. And Clyde Bruckman just continued borrowing from himself over and over and over again because it's all he had. And he eventually borrowed a pistol from his friend Buster Keaton, went to a diner, went to the bathroom, and shot himself in the head. Mm. Thank you, Harold Lloyd. I could never look at him the same way. But once I learned that story, not only was Harold Lloyd a serial cheater on his wife, they say that he had the most illegitimate children around the country. He was quite a hound. And he killed Clyde Bruckman. Mm-hmm. Nice work, Harold. So Clyde Bruckman wrote this, and it is entirely borrowed material. They are efficiency experts. Now, first of all, let's discuss the differences between season one and season two. Season one, Lou, who owned the show, went over budget on the first season and had to cut back on the second season. He didn't have a choice. He had to. So what does that mean? They got rid of all the original music. All the music that went on in the backgrounds that helped the show so much. The opening credits are just Lou yelling, "Hey, Abbott," a weird song. And then it's just the Abbott and Costello Show starring Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. Yeah, we knew that, you know. There's no in front of the curtain scenes setting up the show. This is basically, if you picture Abbott and Costello, let's say working at Columbia or RKO, making short subjects. These are short subjects starring Aaron Costello. I only wish they were better. I wish they had more energy. I wish the boys were less tired. Lou was just coming off another sickness. If you look at the close-ups, he looks so tired. He's got bags under his eyes. Bud looks really older than he was. And the two of them have slowed down to the point where it's like molasses, you know? It's quite a difference, quite a difference. In this episode, they're efficiency experts. So what do? They borrow from W.C. Fields' Man on the Flying Trapeze, where he's an efficiency expert. He's got a desk that looks like, you know, nothing, willy-nilly, papers everywhere, but he knows where everything is. That's the gag. That's what Lou does in this episode. He's got the desk. He knows where everything is. Then Bud tells him, go over to the file cabinet and guess so-and-so's file. And that's his excuse to do stooge material in front of the file cabinet. Every time he closes it, one opens on his leg. He closes that one. Another one hits him in the stomach. It's all stooge stuff. We've seen it done before. We saw Schampauer do it. This is what I mean about the second season. As I'm watching this, and I'm watching the file cabinet thing, there are these explosions of laughter at this file cabinet scene, and totally undeserved. I'm sorry. I don't buy the whole recording thing. I'm sorry. It's, you know, it's funny stuff, but it's not explosively funny stuff. I'm sorry.
No.
So they must have sweetened whatever they're doing here. They sweetened the laughter. So here's the plot. And these are plot heavy shows. They are chosen by their boss to help out a client, a millionaire client who has two daughters, very attractive daughters, who spend way too much money. So he hires Bud and Lou to go and actually live there and teach them to economize. It sounds like disaster, right? But it's really just more stooge stuff that Clyde Bruckman borrowed from himself. First of all, Jean Wills is one of the young ladies, and she was in so many stooge shorts. And then they do the whole thing. It's like, first of all, while Bud and Lou are there, the girls are like, they're so happy that they're there. They're going to take them for a ride. But why does the one want Lou to cut her hair? These millionaire women probably go to these great salons. Why don't you take care of me? You can cut my hair and give me a mud pack and all this stuff. It's basically a way to get them to do stooge gags. So he cuts her hair, and then he accidentally grabs rubber cement instead of the mud pack and actually puts fast drying glue all over her face. In the meantime, Bud is in the kitchen doing curly material. Bud.
Woo, 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 woo.
So, but he's putting the lettuce on the, you know, on the clothesline, and then cutting the lettuce pieces off. And, you know, he's doing all this curly stuff. Right away, that's weird. And then you cut back, and the woman is screaming because she's got her face in the rubber cement. It turns out to work for her, just like in the stooge short. It comes off, and it actually works for her. It makes her skin feel revitalized. So I just don't understand why she allowed Lou Costello to cut her hair. Bud has another one of those lines that I will love forever. And that's when he takes a look at her with the glue on her face. He yells out of the blue and entirely ad-libbed, "She looks like a zombie!" Of course, Bud has a great knowledge of what zombies look like. Probably learned from his psychiatrist friend. anyway, that just tickled me. Now, I don't know if you noticed this, but at some point, Bud starts getting the hang of the fact that the girls are taking them for a ride. And he says, there's something rotten in Denmark. And he says it offhandedly. It's not a major point. But Lou picks up on it immediately and jumps on it. He actually interrupts Bud's line to jump on it because he knows this could be comedy gold, right? What do you mean? What's going on in Denmark? No, there's something rotten in Denmark. What do you mean rotten in Denmark? It just goes back and forth, you know, just like Hold That Ghost with the Gone with the Wind or like Water Under the Bridge. So Lou picked up on it and Bud picked up on Lou's cue, and the two of them do a little bit about Denmark. It's kind of cool. Then we have more Stooge stuff when the girls decide to put rubber inside the cake frosting. And these millionaire women know how to make cakes, of course. Yeah. And this is another Stooge thing where they eat it. And of course, the balloons come out of their mouth, whatever. What I noticed more than anything was how low their energy was. They are both tired in these, as Stinky would say, tired. So when the girls have models come from the local dress shop to model expensive dresses, these two women show up, these two models, but they are obviously not actors. They probably were models or something because they're terrible. They're absolutely awful. At one point, one of them at the end of the scene looks at the camera as if to say, are we finished? So what happens is the girls take them out. They go to a casino and they do material from, are you ready? Lost in Alaska, the roulette table routine, which is probably the best routine in the movie. And it's great. You know, Lou claims to be 10 years younger than he actually was. He says he's 35. And then at one point, they actually set the place on fire. I mean, there seems to be a theme. And they show stock footage of fire engines coming down a busy street. And it's like from 1920. These cars are like Model Ts. They were really cutting the budget here, let me tell you. So it turns out that they blow it. The head of their company is responsible for everything they'd done. It costs him all the money he has. He has to close up because he started selling insurance. And of course, the first place he sold it to was the casino that the boys burned down. So he just tells them all the things that they'd done wrong. And then he asks, do you have anything to say for yourselves? And they both say, yeah, we quit. And then the guy gets up to get them, and they jump out the window. Their two doubles jump out the window. God. So Clyde Bruckman does it again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just one Stooge scene after another. What did you think of that? First of all, just in general, the second season.
In general, the second season. I would rather discuss it in private.
You're like the Buck Private.
As you've said, it pales in comparison, in my opinion, with the first season. It was an interesting concept, actually doing, you know, sitcom type episodes, very different from the first season, but it just didn't work. It didn't work for them. And like this episode, I was out of it at the very beginning when we find out they are efficiency experts and are actually good at their job.
Uh-huh.
They lost me right there.
Seems a tad contrived.
Yes.
Just a tad. I did notice something very important, though. When there is a close-up of Lou, and he's got his hat on, that hat is so stained. It's got stains all over it. So I think he probably used the same hat, I think, for every episode.
Yep, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I noticed anyway. Now, the roulette routine is funny. I think it works here.
Yes, it does.
I think the closing scene with the boss is funny, you know, but the whole episode just doesn't really sustain. I just keep shaking my head and thinking, you know, I've seen this and I've seen it done better. You know,
I
don't think the Stooges were superior to Abbott and Costello in any way, shape or form. But in these scenes, I think, the Stooges had more energy, and Bud and Lou were just sort of walking through this. It's hard to watch. So we come to our next episode during the season two, and that's Public Enemies. Again, written by Clyde Bruckman, which means we're going to see a lot of familiar stuff. you know, produced and directed by Gene Yarborough, of course. Now, this one is interesting. First of all, it opens up with this weird scene where they're guessing people's weight. Now, that's an obvious carnival game, but somehow they acquired this thing where people would sit on the scale and they would have to guess their weight within 3 pounds. And if they don't, I don't know. They didn't explain what they get. It's so ridiculous. The whole thing is just inane. But it leads up to Vita Ann Bork shows up again, looking very pretty. And has a little flirtation with Lou. Bud goes off to get coffee, I remember. I'm getting a cup of coffee. You do 10 minutes. Vita Ann Borg comes up and she's very flirtatious with Lou. And we don't know why. We don't know her. But anyway, that goes on. And then this kind of heavyset lady shows up. And she looks like a lady wrestler. And I'll bet she was in real life because she's built like a truck. And they do some funny stuff with her. Then they just end the whole guess your weight thing. It's just gone. It's like it never existed. But it does set up the flirtation between Vita Ann Borg and Lou. Now, while this is going on, Lou kind of wanders over to the local jailhouse, which happens to be right next door on this busy street. And there's actually a window that you could look through that has bars on the window. And it happens to be the room where they take the pictures of the criminals. Well, this is an old Buster Keaton thing. I think it's from Hard Luck. I could be wrong, but I think it is, where the same thing happens to Keaton. He looks through the window just at the time the guy's taking the picture, and his picture shows up. You know, he's the criminal, and, you know, he's chased through the rest of the short. But anyway, this happens to Lou here, and of course, his picture is shown in the papers, and he's known as a deadly killer and all this stuff. So at the boarding house, Mr. Fields welcomes his new boarders, and I have to say I was absolutely pleased to see my friend Joe Sawyer.
Yes.
As the head crook, you know, and we loved him in Naughty 90s, and he was great in Coming Round the Mountain. He's just terrific, and he's terrific in this. His girlfriend happens to be Vita Ann Borg, and Joe happens to be very jealous. So we have some stuff coming up with Lou and Vita and Joe. So they think that Lou is the guy in the newspaper with the jail cell, you know, bars in front of him. They think he's one of the great con men of all time. And his partner is Slick Williams or whatever his name is. And so Lou tells Bud he has to pretend he's Slick. So Bud, this is what impressed me. When Bud comes into the criminal's apartment, he knows the lingo. Bud knows all the lingo. He knows the language of the con man. And I love that about him. You know, it's something like it's realistic because, you know, he holds back in real life. But when he can use it, he uses it. Yeah. And he knows all the colloquialisms, you know, he knows the language. There's also another ad lib bit with Lou's suspenders. When it gets caught on Joe Sawyer's hand and he's pulling it out of it, I'm noticing Lou's face, and it's ad-lib. That's all something he added. And every time Lou adds something, especially physical, I thank God, because the best episodes are when they do something off the beaten path. You know what I mean? So yeah, it was nice to see the ad-lib. I love Lou with the gun when he finds the gun and he does the little flip thing with his hand and he puts it in the wrong hand. And it's just very funny. But again, the whole thing ends up at a big warehouse where they're going to do a payroll robbery, and they all have to go. So there's like four or five criminals. The girls are waiting in the car. Claire Carlton is one of the girls with Vita Ann Borg, and she's another stooge regular, you know, shows up in their shorts. So they end up at the warehouse, and it's like a Three Stooges finale. In fact, I think the Stooges did it two or three times. So they're doing the gag where, and this is one that my brothers and I used to cry. We'd laugh so hard, is when one of the guys gets knocked out and he's sitting in front of this canvas, like a wall, and Lou puts his arms out and pretends that the guy is still conscious and he's using his hands, you know, to gesticulate while Joe Sawyer is talking to him, to this guy, thinking that he's conscious. What really got me about this scene, watching it last night, was Joe Sawyer standing there just talking and talking and talking and asking and talking some more. He doesn't notice. It's just very funny. They push it to the limit on this one. But we used to love it. We used to think it was so funny. So then they end it with the battering ram. And all I can picture is Shemp being used as a battering ram. And again, Clyde Bruckman, stealing from Clyde Bruckman. And that's what these shows are. These shows are places for Clyde Bruckman to do the last work, really, the last people that would hire him. And, you know, it says a lot about Lou, you know, who's given the guy a break, really. Okay. Number three on our hit parade for the second season. Yeah.
May I say something?
No. So moving on. Of course you can. Please do.
Well, my quick summation on the episode Public Enemies. First of all, the Buster Keaton short was The Goat.
Oh, The Goat. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And the Three Stooges short was actually Shemp's first, called Fright Night.
Fright Night, 1947.
And yes, and Bruckman also just kept the names. In the Keaton short, the criminal was Deadshot Dan.
Wow.
And that's the same name in this one. In the Stooges short, the main tough guy who chases him through the warehouse, his name was Chopper, and that's Joe Sawyer's character's name. In this one, it's like, dude, can't you even just change the names? Come on.
All he did was he went to a Xerox machine using the same names. You know what? My heart goes out to him, honestly. Poor Clyde Bruckman. One of the tragedies of classic Hollywood. That's fascinating. Yeah. Thank you, Jerry. That was good research, because I wouldn't have known. I have to say that of the classic comedians, I think Chaplin made the best shorts in his day. He did those mutuals, the 12 mutuals.
Oh, yeah.
But I'll tell you the truth. I have trouble remembering which Keaton short is which, and you know, some are better than others. I just don't think he was as funny as Chaplin. Mm-hmm. I think Chaplin was more about the performance. And being a performer, I appreciate that more. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to this next episode.
Yes.
And this is an interesting one because it's the first one written by a different person. The first ones were Eddie Foreman. The second and third of this one was Clyde Bruckman. This is a gentleman by the name of Jack Townley, T-O-W-N-L-E-Y. And Jack Townley, actually, before he got to this show, wrote on about 100 films and short subjects. So he really was an incredible writer. He worked all the time. And he was hired to do what Clyde Bruckman didn't do, and namely offer some original material. Jack Townley was born in Kansas City, by the way, in 1896, lived to be 64, died in 1960. And he was the other writer for the second season. And to be honest with you, it's a lot easier to watch Jack Townley's work than it is Bruckman's, because you know that Townley at least is attempting to be original. Okay, so when the show opens, Bud is outside of a restaurant, and we hear this ruckus going on, and Lou's stuntman, and I forget who does it for the TV show, if it's Vic Parks or who, but anyway, does this incredible fall out of the restaurant. He lands on his head.
Yes.
You know, and then the twist and down. It's really terrific. And then, of course, you cut to the close-up of Lou getting up. And he lost his job as a busboy because he spilled some coffee. And Bud is like, why would they fire you for that? Go back and get your job. So he goes back in. And, of course, the stuntman comes out again with another fall on his head. So that doesn't work out. They run into one of my favorite character actors, Fortunio Bonanova. I'll say it again. Fortunio Bonanova, Spanish gentleman. Yes, si. And he usually played Frenchmen or Italians. And he's especially showcased in a little movie called Citizen Kane. He plays Mrs. Kane's singing teacher, teaching her how to sing opera. And he's very funny. And he's very funny in this episode. In fact, he's the best thing about this episode. Okay, so he's apparently a very emotional Frenchman who is the greatest swordsman in the world. Okay, Lou and Bud decide to answer an ad from the newspaper. God forbid they should go to work. A scientist needs a guinea pig to try out a new formula. So Bud immediately volunteers Lou.
Yes.
So they get there, and a great character actor, Byron Folger, who I love, he plays Dr. Bluzak, And Dr. Bluzak has a formula, actually a seat Lou sits in. It's almost like an electric chair. And when he turns it on, you know, it smokes and there's, you know, lightning and everything. And what it does is it renders the person, you can't hurt this person for 24 hours. This person yep. cannot feel pain for 24 hours. So they're, you know, they thank the doctor, they get their $100 and they leave and things start happening. And Lou does not get hurt. A vase falls from a, you know, third story window and misses him. The guy comes out and Lou tells him, you know, is yelling at him, how dare you do that? You should be more careful, blah, blah, blah. And the guy ends up punching Bud in the nose and Bud, you know, takes the brunt of it and Lou, no pain. And then they've come upon a bank robbery and it's only one guy, you know, still I say only one guy and the cops are having a gun battle with him. And Lou shows up and says, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. I can't get hurt. And he actually walks up through the gunplay and takes the guy's gun, puts the guy in a phone booth and locks him in. And he becomes a hero. So that story gets around. One thing I have to mention to you before I go any further, because I'll probably forget. When Lou takes off his coat at any time during this episode, do you ever notice what's on his pocket?
No.
The name Lou is sewn into his shirt. The shirt must cost a fortune. You know what I mean? So he's wearing his own clothes for this episode.
Oh.
If you look closely. It's not even his initials. It just says Lou. I wonder which shirt is mine. Ah, there, Lou. So, okay. We come to the point where Lou is full of himself, knowing that he can't get hurt. And I mean, it's proven. He does the oven bit, you know, from Laurel and Hardy, where he turns it on before he lights it. And it's going on through an entire scene. The gas is running. And he asks Mr. Fields for a match. He goes in and there's a huge explosion. And only Bud and Mr. Fields are affected by it. And Lou is completely fine. It doesn't exactly, you know, make sense. Again, it doesn't make sense when he finds out that it doesn't, you know, it's not supposed to work. Why did this work? I don't get it. Anyway, what I find interesting about this is that when Bud finds out that the doctor, Dr. Bluzak, is a lunatic and that none of this is true, he runs back to tell Lou because Lou is set to have a duel with Fortunio Bonanova. Knowing that he can't get hurt. So, of course, you know, he really plays it up. But Bud comes back and says he was a fencing expert in school. Bud in school? Bud, a fencing expert? Did he learn this when he had his snowshoes and his golf clubs and his hunting rifle? And who are these people? I know all about fencing. I can teach you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. Here's another thing Bud does. He wants to call Fortunio Bonanova, who lives in an entirely different apartment in the building. And he just picks up the phone, he dials four numbers, and he gets him. When did he call Fortunio Bonanova before? How does he know this number? It makes no sense. So anyway, even the cop knows Fortunio. The cop knows him. The cop is supposed to protect Bud and Lou. But anyway, this starts the whole thing with the sword play and blah, blah, blah. And the big punchline is he shows up at the duel dressed in a suit of armor. And after Fortunio slaps him in the face with his glove, Lou slaps him in the face with his metal glove and knocks him out. And then knocks out Mr. Fields, who's actually Fortunio's second. I don't know. He must have got paid if I know Mr. Fields. So that's the end of our third episode from the second season. Your assessment, Mr. Jerry?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the main reasons I picked this particular episode was because it was different.
Yes.
Just the whole concept, you know, the storyline itself was different from almost anything else in the second season.
Mm-hmm.
And so that grabbed my attention. I love the payoff with the armor and a joke that just gets kind of thrown in. It's an old one, but it still made me laugh.
Lou, you can have anything you want tonight. Anything at all. Anything your heart desires.
Anything at all?
Anything at all.
Can you bring me some strawberries?
Well, they're out of season, Lou.
I'll wait.
I laughed at that too. I'm such an idiot. I laughed at
that. And to me, what sells that joke is Lou's delivery. You know, let's just give him a blanket praise right now. The fact that it just came right in, you know, they're out of season. I'll wait.
Yes.
No pause, just boom, right there.
Underplayed and very natural. Well, here we are. We finally looked at the filmed television show. I much prefer the Colgate Comedy Hour. Mm-hmm. I just think it's almost an honor to watch them work with a live audience. You're actually seeing who Abbott and Costello really are and were, as opposed to, you know, doing a filmed series where, again, it's in a can. You know, it was done in a can. It's not spontaneous. You know, it's Abbott and Costello, so there is a level of spontaneity. But it just isn't like watching them work live. And that's my opinion, you know. And I'm sure a lot of people are saying, no, it's not true. The TV show is the best thing they ever did. That's only coming from people who really aren't movie buffs, who don't realize that their work in films really was the best work they ever did. I'm not talking about, you know, seeing them live in Las Vegas or whatever. I'm talking about the stuff they did that we could still watch today. Their movie work is the best. And, you know, if you're not a movie buff, you're not going to want to sit through songs. You're not going to want to sit through a love story or any of that stuff. To me, it's all part of it. It's all part of their legacy. And the comedy in those films, it's worth sitting through those musical numbers and the love story to get to the best versions, really, of 90% of their material. And if you don't like their movies, I don't think you like Abbott and Costello all that much. Maybe you do, and you save all your love for the TV show. But to me, it reflects, and this is where I'm going to insult everyone. As I've mentioned many times before, the Three Stooges are considered the best and the most memorable of the classic era comedians. That's just the way it is. It's an obvious statement I'm making. And to me, that only proves that we have dumbed down as a nation culturally. And if that insults you, I'm sorry, but to me, it's the truth. The Three Stooges, a team that if you watched three of their movies in a row, you saw everything they can do. You don't need to watch another one, honestly. And that's, again, it's my opinion. To compare them to Chaplin, to compare them to Keaton or W.C. Fields or the Marx Brothers or Abbott and Costello or Laurel and Hardy. No, sorry. Mm-hmm. They are a level below all of the people I just mentioned. And that's coming from a lifelong comedian, you know, someone who studied comedy his whole life. Now, of course, a lot of this is just opinion, and I'm sure you all have your opinions, and I value all of them, and you have every right to them. But this is mine, and I just feel like the TV show is not their best representation. It just isn't. If there were a bit more care maybe placed on it, especially during the second season, maybe I would feel a little bit better about it. But I feel like their radio show, I just think it's less than. I think they had better in them, and it wasn't the best. It wasn't the best of Abbott and Costello.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jer?
Well, I'm going to surprise everybody in our listening audience and say, I agree with you.
Well, sorry. You really shocked me because I was expecting the other answer.
My question to you, however, and I'm going to ask this on behalf of our listeners, we've got the 52 filmed episodes right there available. They're streamed. You know, you can buy the DVD, Blu-ray, whatever set you want. There they are. I have probably only seen at most three full Colgate episodes.
Really?
Where are they? Where can we find them? How can we watch them?
There are a lot of them on YouTube, first of all. There are some that are still missing. You know, I think there's like four or five that are like holy grails, you know. But if you go on YouTube, there you'll find them. If you put in Colgate Comedy Hour, not only will you get a selection of Abbott and Costello's, you'll get Martin and Lewis, Bob Hope, Donald O'Connor. I mean, seriously. But the Abbott and Costello's will be there. And again, it's a privilege to watch them live. You mm-hmm. can almost squint your eyes and pretend you're there watching them, you know, because it's not filmed. It's not stop and go. It is a sustained performance. And like Matthew mentions in the thing I read earlier, you see the hard work. You see Lou sweating like a pig while he's doing all this physical stuff. He's killing himself in front of us. It's amazing what he does. And Bud, less so. I mean, I'm going to say, you know, he's 9 years older. In the earlier episodes of Colgate, he seems to be a bit more on it, you know. Mm-hmm. But as the show progresses, you see him becoming a little bit more slurry in his delivery. His timing is just a tiny tad off. So it's starting to take its toll on Bud. And, you know, Lou, as they got towards the end, he was just ready to stop doing all this stuff that was killing him and doing what other actors were doing in Hollywood, you know, showing up, filming a scene, and that's that, you know. You don't have to fall from a barn onto a pitchfork, you know. So it was a lot easier. So anyway, that's our assessment of the Abbott and Costello show. And I'm not sure what we're going to be looking at in the next episode, but we will come up with something compelling, and we will see you then. Jerry, thank you. As usual, a wonderful time, and thank you so much for all of your work and your research. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And back at you as well, because honestly, without you, I would just be sitting here talking to my laptop, really, and that's not very exciting.
Well, it could be. You know, if you dress it up a little, put some makeup on it, you know, maybe take it out for a meal. Do you know Emil? He lives down the street. All right. Before I make everyone sick, I'm going to say goodbye, and we will see you on episode number 53. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Take care.